call it Hemingway's how-to book. Here on page 170, Maria was holding a single-edged razor blade. Pilar showed me how to use it, she said. You must make the cut here, just below the ear, and draw it toward here. There's a big artery there. You cannot miss it. There's no pain. That's right, said Robert Jordan. That's the carotid artery. Okay. The famous novel For Whom the Bell Tolls tells the reader how to blow up bridges, use automatic weapons, date Spanish girls, and painlessly commit suicide with a straight razor. All the heroes are Republicans. I don't lie. It's a favorite book of John McCain and Barack Obama. For Whom the Bell Tolls, bedside reading on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, July 17th. What does Obama and McCain's favorite book tell us about them that their speeches and TV ads don't? We'll take a closer look. Also, a new oil headline, prices are dropping. Republicans in Congress, are they deserting President Bush? Osama bin Laden's former driver on trial, lessons for the future of Guantanamo detainees. That and all the news. The State Department has not commented on a new report. The U.S. plans to set up a diplomatic presence in Iran for the first time since 1979. The story from the British newspaper The Guardian comes a day after officials announced the U.S. will send a top diplomat to international talks about Iran's nuclear programs, talks that will include Iranian officials. Defense Secretary Robert Gates says the Pentagon is looking for ways to send more troops to Afghanistan, as he put it, sooner rather than later, to deal with the accelerating threat of an increasingly sophisticated Taliban fighters.
Also in Afghanistan, at least 10 insurgents have been killed by Afghan and NATO-led airstrikes that targeted a cell in western Afghanistan today. The militant group is suspected in a series of kidnappings and may have had at least 15 hostages. The Bush administration's rescue plan for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac is meeting resistance from some lawmakers, including Republicans on Capitol Hill. Critics say they're wary of the potential risk to taxpayers of increasing lines of credit to the government-backed mortgage giants.
Yesterday, Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke assured lawmakers on Capitol Hill that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are in, quote, no danger of failing. He also talked about rising inflation.
Inflation has remained high, running at nearly a 3.5% annual rate over the first 5 months of this year. And with gasoline and other consumer energy prices rising in recent weeks, inflation seems likely to move temporarily higher in the near term.
In June, inflation rose at the fastest rate in 26 years.
All right, in politics, John McCain holds a town meeting in Kansas City, Missouri before heading to Michigan. Barack Obama's wife and sister are both holding events on his behalf today. Oil prices dropped another $4 yesterday, $134 a barrel. The S&P begins trading after a big surge yesterday at 1245. Do you really know what you're eating? New York City is making some chain restaurants post a calorie count. Here's a person checking out the chips and salsa from Chipotle Grill right near our studios.
Chips and salsa, almost 700 calories. That's through the roof. I never would have thought corn and vegetables. It's salsa.
Lots of
right?
surprises.
It's salsa, right?
Calorie surprises. We want to know what food gets a bad rap. What food has a calorie count that surprises and shocks you? 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. We begin on Capitol Hill, where in the waning days of the Bush administration, it's safe to say that the branches of government are in the state of a certain amount of competitive tension. But certainly the different branches of government hold each other in the highest of esteem. Here's the tone from Capitol Hill as Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid speaks about President Bush's veto threat.
A veto by the president? Gee whiz, who would be afraid of him? He's got a 29% approval rating. How in the world How in the world could anybody be afraid of him vetoing a bill? I can't imagine why anyone would care about that.
Okay, maybe the gloves are off on Capitol Hill. In the waning days of the Bush administration, what is going on? Republicans are distancing themselves from a perceived to be unpopular president. Democrats, it's kind of open season on the president, as you can hear from Senator Harry Reid. We thought we would take a look at what's changing in this kind of pre-election silly season on Capitol Hill. Joining us now is Todd Zwillick from Capitol News Connection. Todd, in the election sort of lead up to November and the end of the congressional session, it really feels like everyone's going in a different direction here.
Yeah, well, Bush is a lame duck president, John. It's nothing new for members of a lame duck president's party to start to distance themselves from the president a little bit. I think what's remarkable in this case is just how unpopular this particular president is. Senator Harry Reid was right taking his gloves off. The former boxer, by the way, taking his gloves off there. He's always got the gloves off, by the way. You should know that. He's right there. It's a 28-29% approval rating, so it's not a surprise that Democrats would be going for the throat, and a lot of Republicans, particularly Republicans who are running for re-election in the Senate, you know, only one-third of them, but Republicans who are running for re-election this time around are distancing themselves from him.
How aggressively are they distancing themselves? I mean, we've seen the Medicare bill just recently, and that's Harry Reid is referring to. But, you know, what is it that distinguishes this amount of distancing?
I think it's the profile of the issues. You mentioned Medicare, which is a big, important issue to a lot of people, of course, seniors. But let's not forget about the AMA, the doctors, one of the most powerful and ubiquitous lobbies in Washington, D.C. On the first Medicare vote a couple of weeks ago, just real quickly, a lot of Republicans didn't vote the way the AMA wanted to. And the AMA let them know it. They went into the states of those people. In some cases, they yanked their campaign money. Very publicly, they ran ads against them, and a lot of Republicans flipped. And what happened just the other day was you saw an override of the president's veto on Medicare. That's one high-profile example. There was the Farm Bill earlier this year, which was a gigantic $380 billion five-year bill filled with subsidies and tax breaks and, you know, farm policy for the whole country. Not a small bill. Republicans abandoned the White House in droves on that bill. And again, a veto with a huge override with Republican support.
Do you think the Bush administration is taking one, you know, taking a sword for the team here on staking out some positions that make it easy for Republicans to campaign against them? Being distant from George W. Bush may be an important campaign position for a lot of these lawmakers.
Yeah, you know, I really do think that, you know, a lot of people around Capitol Hill, when the president vetoed the Medicare bill, which was very popular with the AMA, an important Republican constituency, popular with a lot of Republicans, and it was clear that there was a veto-proof majority that passed this bill before he overrode it. People were saying, God, the president's crazy. Why would he veto this? He knows he's going to lose. I think the president is crazy like a fox.
Right. We'll definitely see how this plays between now and November. We should note that an intelligence bill is going to pass the House today. It's not going to have torture language attached. And on national security issues, the president is seeming to get what he wants from lawmakers. Todd Zwillick from Capitol News Connection, thanks for joining us.
A pleasure.
Adora?
We've spent many days, John, talking about oil prices, its oil resources, what's available worldwide. And we have some new headlines, it seems. The price per barrel plunged yesterday for a two-day dip of nearly $11 a barrel. And this morning, it's holding steady, trading on the Asian markets around $135 a barrel. A number of factors might help explain the dip, but perhaps the greater debate might be about how volatile the markets are right now and how much American demand affects the global price. Joining us now is Jad Muwad, who's covering the story for the New York Times. Good morning, Jad.
Good morning.
How did this price drop?
Well, like you said, this has been a pretty strong two-day drop. On Monday, we've had the biggest drop in 19 years, one day drop in 19 years, and so we've reached a level we came from the mid 140s to the mid 130s, and it seems to me that the market is really looking here for a tipping point, and it's testing the sort of, you know, how much further could prices drop or not.
But what triggered it? Was there one thing in particular, or was it a series of things?
Yeah, there were a bunch of things. I mean, over 2 days, Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Fed, was testifying in Congress, and he gave a pretty bleak assessment of, you know, the sort of the state of the economy, which is not new, but which kind of gelled in the mind of a lot of traders and investors that, you know, things are really bad. Then we had, you know, very strong inflation numbers. Obviously, you know, prices are going up across the board, and one big factor behind this is high energy prices. And then you've had also a kind of a shifting of the geopolitical, you know, sort of picture. You know, last week Iran was testing missiles, and you know, there's a lot of talk about, you know, whether Israel or even the U.S. would take military action against Iran, and that obviously pushed prices towards $150. And then, you know, 2 days ago, the Bush administration said it would send its highest level talks with Iran over the weekend, over Iran's nuclear program. So obviously that takes a big chunk of the geopolitical risk off the table, at least for this week.
But one point that you report in your story today is about the demand in the United States, that gas demand has fallen over 5%. How significant is that in the global need for oil?
Right. Well, the global oil market is kind of, you know, sort of working at two speeds here. In the U.S. and in sort of, you know, developed countries where people see the prices and pay the real market price, demand is falling, and falling pretty dramatically. The U.S. number that you quote is a big drop. But on the other hand, the U.S. may be the biggest oil consumer, but a big chunk of the world, you know, China, India, the Middle East, is still growing. It's growing because economic growth is still, you know, strong in these countries, and the oil demand is growing because prices are subsidized by the government. And so we have a situation now where oil prices are rising because demand is rising in one part of the world, even as, you know, the U.S. U.S. drivers are consuming less gasoline.
Jed, I'm wondering if there's an accelerator here. There's been a lot of talk over the last few weeks about new players in the market, the so-called speculators, and that if demand begins to plateau and, as you say, geopolitical worries begin to dissipate, if those speculators, those so-called new players in the market, see these kinds of fluctuations, they jump in and sell, and that accounts for these enormous fluctuations that we've seen in the last 2 days.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point, and you really have to wonder about the huge volatility we've been seeing in the market. Obviously, speculators, financial investors, have been blamed for pushing up oil prices very quickly and very high. These trades can go both ways, and I think, you know, what you may see, and I don't know that we're there yet or not, what you may see is that if the market really turns against oil, you could see very big drops very quickly. $10 drop over 4 days, 4 or 5 days, is pretty significant. And if the market kind of tips over those kind of psychological, stepping stones, if you will, you could see sort of $10 declines over, you know, the course of a few weeks, and we could get down very quickly.
Very quickly, what should we be looking for? What should we pay attention to?
Well, one thing I look for, because of the way this sort of market is working, is what is demand doing in other countries outside of the developed world? You know, mm-hmm. What is demand going to do in China and India and the Middle East? And one thing to look for is what happens in China after the Olympics.
After the Olympics. Jad Muad, thank you.
Thank you.
Jad Muad is the New York Times energy reporter, and he was giving us an update on the many ingredients that make up the oil prices worldwide and here in the United States.
How far can oil prices fall? Respond to anything on the program at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253. Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. A couple of quick things. Here in New York, fast food places are having to post this month calorie counts on food items. We want to know if you have a favorite food item that gets a bad calorie rap and you'd like to defend it for us here on the air. 877-8-MY-TAKE. Or just tell us if your behavior would change if you knew the calories of the food that you eat. You can reach us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. We're also talking about the price of oil. How much farther do you want it to drop? Drop $10 in the last 2 days. And we're also talking about Guantanamo Bay. Do you think Guantanamo Bay should be closed or remain open? We've been told for nearly the last 8 years that the detention center at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba is at the center of the war on terror. But increasingly, and particularly this year, it's been a showcase on a forum and kind of a window on constitutional law in the United States as the Bush administration uses Guantanamo and the hearings down there as its approach to seeking justice for alleged terrorists who are detained down there versus the Supreme Court and court decisions in the appellate level, which are increasingly critical of the entire Guantanamo Bay operation. We've asked Neil Sonnett, who's an observer of the Gitmo Military Commission trials for the American Bar Association, to join us this morning. He's on the phone from Miami. Neil, thanks for being with us.
Good morning. My pleasure.
A couple of things. I mean, we've seen the release of this interrogation video this week. The Hamdan II pretrial hearings are going on. Osama bin Laden's former driver could be the first detainee in decades to face an American war crimes trial. It also appears as though the American judiciary, from the Supreme Court all the way on down, is strongly critical of this entire justice strategy of the Bush administration. Do you see a tipping point somewhere nearby that might motivate the Bush administration to completely change the way they're approaching detainees?
Well, I certainly hope so, and there may be a tipping point coming as early as today because there is a motion pending to halt the Hamdan trial in Gitmo. But for my own trial commitments here in Miami, I would have been there as the American Bar Association's observer. And I should add very quickly, John, that while I chair the ABA Task Force on Treatment of Enemy Combatants and I am their observer down there, this morning I'm speaking for myself. I don't speak for the ABA.
Right. The ABA hasn't yet taken a position on this, but I suspect there's a pretty powerful debate going on among attorneys such as yourself over the Bush administration's strategy. And one side of that debate suggests that all detainees should just be put into federal court.
Well, the federal courts have certainly proved themselves capable of handling these cases, and some of them, or perhaps all of them, should be tried in the federal courts. A report by Human Rights First several weeks ago examined the terrorism prosecutions in federal court and concluded that the federal courts are more than able to handle them. The problem with the military commission system that is now in place in Guantanamo is that it just doesn't provide for due process or fair trials. And giving fair trials to these detainees, these people who have been charged in the military commissions, is not just important for them. It's really not about them. It's about us. It's about whether or not the United States can continue to maintain that it has a truly democratic free system. And we have to make sure that the trials that we conduct are fair trials and that they are seen throughout the world to be fair trials. Otherwise, we lose the high moral ground to be able to talk about our system of justice.
The thorny issue here, though, is one of jurisdiction, and my colleague and our resident legal expert here, Adora Udoji, suggested that we make the point here that there are a number of competing jurisdictions. The Hamdan case is in front of a military commission, right?
Yes.
And what are the other jurisdictions in play? There are sort of the federal court jurisdiction, the military commission, and then is the judge advocate involved at all?
Well, the Judge Advocate General's Corps provides the lawyers for these proceedings, but there really are only two different jurisdictions that are now in play. One is the Military Commission, only for those a few detainees who have been charged with crimes, and then the United States District Courts, the civilian federal courts, who are now handling the habeas corpus petitions for those detainees who have languished in Guantanamo, some for as much as 6 years, without having any kind of a hearing or ever being charged with any offense.
But couldn't Hamdan then challenge in federal court the charges he's facing now?
He is, and
so he's in both courts. Then he's facing charges in the military tribunal, and he's concurrently challenging those charges in federal court.
Yes, he has filed a petition for habeas corpus and filed a request asking a judge in Washington, D.C. to halt the proceedings in Guantanamo.
And that's the ruling that you say may come today, right?
That's correct.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, of course, the military judge in Guantanamo is proceeding with pretrial motions that are going on now.
Quickly, Neil, the DOD, the Department of Defense, says the 265 detainees at Guantanamo are terrorist trainers, terrorist financiers, bomb makers, bin Laden bodyguards, recruiters and facilitators, and would-be suicide bombers. Do you think we're ever going to know in a court of law whether any of those claims are true?
Well, that's the purpose of habeas corpus, is to have the government provide proof that these people are being properly detained. And there have been enough studies done independently now to demonstrate that very few of the people at Guantanamo are truly terrorists. Many of them, most of them, were never picked up on the battlefield, but were sold to the United States by Pakistanis or Northern Alliance troops for bounties that reached $10,000 or higher. And that's the reason that of the 750 or so that were originally held, we're down to 260 or so now.
Wow, there's the takeaway. Neil, that's a great point. Thanks for making it. Neil Sonnen is an observer of the Gitmo Military Commission trials for the American Bar Association, watching both at Gitmo and in Washington for developments today. Thank you, Neil.
My pleasure.
And now we have headlines from Femi Oke. Femi?
Hello, they're just coming up to 29 minutes past the hour. Facing a Taliban resurgence, Pentagon leaders signal an increase in troops in Afghanistan sooner than expected. A car bomb in Baghdad kills 18, including 7 children. Ben Bernanke says that the government-backed mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are not in danger of failing. And Pope Benedict is in Australia. He's calling for the earth to be protected for future generations. More on his green message in a forthcoming newscast. But if you're a little bit bored of the political roundup and all of the campaigns, here's something that might cheer you up. There's a viral video right now that's going around. It's by the creators known as Jib Jab, and they're very good at doing some very tongue-in-cheek, sarcastic musical numbers. Here's a little snippet from their latest one. Time for some campaigning. It's a little bit with featuring Senator Obama.
Gosh, I'm so tired of divisive exchange, and I got one or two things to say about change, like the change we must change to the change we hold dear. I really like change.
Got a little free time over there in the newsroom, Femi?
You didn't find that amusing? That YouTube.
Good. There's a McCain
one. Check out the
one.
Whole video there.
There's a McCain one that's pretty funny, too.
Yeah, that's your news.
Thank you, Femi.
Thanks,
you're welcome.
Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, now featuring Mandy and Lester, a short film about a girl who loses 2 boxes of Scout cookies, a boy who finds those cookies, and who finds that returning them isn't going to be as simple as it seems. Available at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. It's Thursday, July 17th, and increasingly we've been reporting about clashes between NATO and U.S. on the one side and the Taliban on the other. There's certainly been an escalation in recent weeks, triggering many questions about the renewed strength of the Taliban. Award-winning documentary filmmaker Sean Langing, who'd already made 2 films on the Islamic militants, found himself in the midst of this evolution this year. Planning on an interview with top commanders, he was taken hostage for 3 months. Langing was released just 3 weeks ago, and he joins us now. Welcome, Sean.
Hi. Yeah, it's nice to be here.
I'm sure it is. At what point did you realize you were in serious trouble?
Well, exactly. Slightly later than I think normal kidnap victims would be, because I was actually undercover and I'd been invited by the Taliban to interview them. So it was only, I crossed the border actually from Afghanistan into Pakistan. And it was only on day four when they entered the room I was being kept in and said, there is no interview, you're under arrest, that I realized this was no longer a typical, for me at least, undercover situation, and that I was now under arrest by the Taliban.
And what went through your mind?
When you're arrested by the Taliban and they accuse me of being a spy, you think at that point you're dead, because that's not a good situation to be in, and they behead people they accuse of being spies. And perhaps unfairly, I didn't have much faith in their justice system.
So they put you under arrest, and you were kept in a room. Mm. Describe that room and how they treated you.
Yeah, I can describe that room rather well, because for 3 months I was kept in a very gloomy, dark room. There was it was about 9 foot by 10 foot wide. Two beds, two hard beds, one for me and one for my translator. And just when you asked me, you know, what went through my mind, he had a nervous breakdown, a mental and physical breakdown, because as an Afghan, he had very good personal experience of what it's like to be held by the Taliban, and he was sure they were going to kill us. So we had a small hole for our bathroom facilities, and the one window was covered up from the outside, so there was just a hint of daylight. And in fact, my only window onto the world was, one actually was the BBC World Service, which really was a lifeline. They left me a radio. But the other was a small 5 inches by 3 inch hole, which I looked through every day. And I could look out onto a few branches of an apricot tree. So I was kept in the dark for 3 months.
When you said you could hear the BBC service, did you ever hear any reports about your kidnapping?
No, and that was quite difficult. It was, I pretty much realized there was a reason for that, because I know a lot of foreign journalists, and I knew they knew I must be missing, and it wasn't on the news. And of course, it turned out, I learned later, that the Taliban had threatened to kill me if it was in the news. And that's quite unusual. They normally announce it themselves. But I think it was the difference between my case and many other cases was I was kidnapped in Pakistan, and that made it a much more sensitive issue.
And you were taken to what's called Waziristan. No.
I was in a tribal agency called Bajor, which is just across the border from Afghanistan and next to a place in Afghanistan called Kunar, where the Americans are based. And there's a lot of heavy fighting there. And the interesting thing about having the radio was I would be listening on the radio about a report of a U.S. drone hitting a house in the tribal agencies of Pakistan. But the night before, I'd heard the drone myself and heard the faint explosion. And even though I was locked in a dark room for 3 months and I wasn't allowed out, it's amazing what you can pick up. And every day I could hear test firing from the surrounding Taliban training camps. The reason why I went there to Pakistan, because as you said in your introduction, I'd made documentaries about the Taliban in Afghanistan, but many of the allegations are that their training camps are over the border in Pakistan, and that's their safe haven where they train, they recuperate, and they mount cross-border attacks on US and British forces. So that's why I went. And of course, perhaps I went too far, I think, this time.
We always hear the saying when people find themselves in difficult situations that they see their lives flash before their eyes. Clearly, this must have applied in your circumstance. And how did you cope exactly? Yeah. You wrote a journal?
Yeah, I definitely had that drowning man experience. And it's very real, and it's caused by adrenaline and cortisone being gushed through your brain, that survival instinct. And so I could see, I had instant recall of every moment of my life from childhood. I could name every teacher. I could remember what people looked like, what they were wearing the first time I met them 20 years ago. So it's quite an intense experience. There was also a lot of fear, because you could hear the constant fire of the from the training camps around. I was surrounded by training camps. Also, the people in the house I was being kept in, they were locals, you know, would constantly talk about, you know, the Taliban checkpoints around their house and how they would sometimes be picked up for not having the right length of beard, and how even there were Arabs in the surrounding area. So I was very much aware of where I was, the situation I was in. And as far as treatment is concerned, you know, they fed me. I was questioned at length, but never tortured, or there was no physical abuse. But the throughout.
So what insight, Sean, did you get from your captivity as a journalist and a filmmaker about the Taliban, about these people who are the focus of your efforts as a reporter?
Yeah. As a filmmaker, not much, because obviously I wasn't allowed to film. But I did gain an insight I hadn't gained in the many years I've been filming in Afghanistan or with Islamist groups and militant groups, and including the Taliban. I lived in Afghanistan during their regime. And when you interview them, obviously they're always showing you their best side. But when you spend 3 months held by them, you see their real side. And it was much darker than I'd previously been witness to.
Wow.
I was confronted daily by a level of intolerance, ignorance, and hypocrisy. It did leave me slightly. I mean, I very much have a more of a real insight to them. And the hypocrisy is, you know, that it's about money. They're businessmen, a lot of them. They're criminals. The nexus between smugglers, heroin, jihad was very clear to me inside there. But journalistically, one thing I realized sitting in that room for 3 months. And hearing the news from the surrounding area is that, you know, I know it's been in the news in America, and Barack Obama, the presidential candidate, has been referring a lot to the need to concentrate on Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
I'd been in Afghanistan when it was a safe haven for Taliban and Al-Qaeda.
Sean Langing, we're going to have to leave it there. An incredible journey, and we thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Sean Langing, a British journalist and filmmaker who was held hostage by the Taliban for 3 months. He said he saw a darker side.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji.
And we are so shifting gears here on the program. If you're in New York this month, you're noticing at fast food restaurants that calories are being posted on menu items. And some of the numbers are eye-popping, and some of them
shocking.
Are pretty surprising. It's a New York rule that the Bloomberg administration has forced onto fast food places here. It's controversial, but it's very, very interesting. And it motivated us to concoct what we like to think of as the fast food calorie sorting game here. All right? And we're going to play it in the next 3 minutes. And we've asked a chef, a top chef, actually, Camille Bashara, who was a contestant on the Bravo show Top Chef, right?
Correct.
You are an actual chef.
Yes, I am.
You know a thing or two about food, correct?
I do.
We have 5 items that we brought in from fast food places here in the New York area. A McDonald's Big Mac, a Dunkin' Donuts Everything Bagel with Cream Cheese, a Wendy's Chicken BLT Salad, you see it?
Mm-hmm.
A Dunkin' Donuts Old Fashioned Cake Donut, and a Starbucks Strawberry and Cream Frappuccino. I can't miss that over there. Your job, your mission, Camille, is to order those in lowest to highest calories. 5 is the lowest calories, 1 is the highest calories, and you have about a minute to do it. Are you ready?
I am ready.
Get set, go.
Wow, okay. I will go with lowest calorie on the salad.
Okay, she's picked the salad for the lowest.
Camille, are you sure about that?
Dora is offering some
what I'm doing
there.
Is I may shift things around, but I'm going to start
a little lack
with,
of confidence.
For a chef, I don't know if I'm going to head to your Paloma restaurant in Brooklyn
no, you
if you're
must.
Not getting this one right.
Well, it's quite early for a chef, I will say, in
about
my defense.
About 40 seconds.
Okay.
The Everything Bagel is a number 2 pick.
Let's see. for going from high to low. Number one is the most calories, and number five is the lowest calories.
A lot of focus on the Frappuccino.
Number five is the lowest, and...
All right, time's up.
Oh, my goodness.
Adora, the results, please.
Oh, my goodness. Let's see. Camille has chosen the Big Mac as the lowest calorie meal.
No. Start with five.
Oh, five is the salad, lowest calorie.
Okay, great.
Right?
Yes.
Four is the Frappuccino that you have. Three is the old-fashioned donut. Two is the bagel with cream cheese. And one is the Big Mac. So you're saying that the Big Mac has the most calories.
Correct.
What's the real order, Adora?
The real order is the lowest calories is the plain old-fashioned donut. 280 calories. You got that one
wrong. You had that as three, Camille.
The second lowest, McDonald's Big Mac, is 540. You chose that as the one with the most, and it only has 540.
Shocking.
The next is... Dunkin' Donuts Everything Bagel with Cream Cheese, 560 calories. The next, the Frappuccino, 570 calories.
That was
and
number
ding,
two.
Ding, ding, ding. Number one, all-time big calorie meal on the table, Wendy's BLT salad.
At 780 calories, the one you picked as the lowest was actually the highest.
I can't believe that.
Are you shocked?
I am. Very, very shocked.
Does this mean that chefs aren't aware of calories as much as they are of ingredients?
I think chefs aren't aware of fast food is what it is.
Oh, you're too good for fast food. Is that what you're saying, Camille?
I hate to admit that, but yes.
But imagine, dieters go for the Big Mac and the donut, okay? And,
you'll do better.
The gluttons eat the salad and the Frappuccino. Camille Bissara,
only
thanks for joining us. Only in America.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. We want to start right off with headlines from Femi. Okay, we weren't able to get to you in the last segment. Femi, give it to us.
Hi there. 12 minutes to the hour. The Pentagon is looking to send more troops to Afghanistan this year in response to increasing well-planned insurgent attacks. The government has ordered that airlines install new technology to prevent explosions in aircraft fuel tanks, and the device prevents the type of explosion that destroyed the TWA Flight 800 12 years ago. CNN is also reporting that FEMA gave state agencies in Mississippi the other hurricane-ravaged states' household items intended for victims of Hurricane Katrina. The Mississippi Gaming Commission and Department of Corrections were given things like coffee makers, pillows, tents, hand sanitizers. And a Russian warship is heading to Arctic waters today to conduct patrols for the first time since the breakup of the Soviet Union. One story that we're looking at in a lot of detail here on the show this morning. The State Department has not confirmed or denied rumors that the U.S. might be planning to set up a special interest section in Tehran. Not quite an embassy, but the first step toward establishing one in Iran in almost 30 years. That story was broken by the Guardian newspaper in London. I spoke to the bureau chief in Washington, D.C. He said everything is in the story. And we stick by it.
Yes, well, they're being very cagey in Washington, the State Department, about that story. Thanks, Fem.
You're welcome.
State Department caginess? Huh. Presidential hopefuls Barack Obama and John McCain, well, we're all aware they disagree on many things. But oddly enough, you may not know when it comes to books, they share a favorite.
He lay flat on the brown, pine-needled floor of the forest, his chin on his folded arms, and high overhead the wind blew in the tops of the pine trees. The mountainside sloped gently where he lay, but below it was steep, and he could see the dark of the oiled road winding through the pass.
That's actor Campbell Scott reading the opening lines from the 1940 Hemingway classic For Whom the Bell Tolls. It's the classic story about the brutality of war, about camaraderie, political ideology, and the contemplation of death during the Spanish Civil War. Jim Fitzmaurice, it's an interesting choice for two men with very different political leanings.
Yeah, I think so. It's a politically shrewd choice, though, when you think about it. I mean, it's a very, very popular novel that actually is very accessible while at the same time being considered highbrow and a literary classic. So in that way, it's almost politically calculated that it shows that both of them can read very sophisticated novels that nonetheless anybody else can read. But what's
Jim
interesting
Fitzmorris, I just want to introduce you. You're a professor of theater history and literature at Tulane University. And you say there's certainly lots of parallels, very different parallels, for both John McCain and Barack Obama to the protagonist, Robert Jordan, in the book, who gave up his life as a college professor to fight fascism in Spain. What are those parallels?
Well, I think that both men's life trajectory shows a certain kind of self-identification with the central character. Jordan is a teacher in the United States who comes to Spain to fight for a cause larger than himself. And in the same sort of way, if you look at both McCain's career, which has been about sacrifice, duty, and honor, and in a lot of ways Obama passing up the cushy jobs he could have gotten on Wall Street given his law grades and the kind of work he had done in school, he actually decides to go into inner city Chicago and become a community activist. Mm-hmm. And so in that way, I think you could actually make a really strong case that both men identify with this central character. The other way they can really identify is that they are not of a particular group. Both are considered to some degree mavericks. Both are considered non-traditional politicians. And while Jordan, of course, is very much a loyalist, is very much on the loyalist side and about helping the Republican cause in the novel, he very much is a man apart.
And he gets disillusioned very quickly. He is someone who had great commitment to ideology, but was disillusioned.
Yeah, and what's interesting about the novel, too, is that as his disillusionment with what goes on around him gets stronger and stronger, he becomes much more enamored with the idea of particular and personalized character. I mean, in so many ways, he comes to admire people, individuals, rather than organizations, groups, or great movements.
Can you really imagine John McCain and Barack Obama blowing up bridges and falling in love with Maria and, carrying those carbine rifles through the mountains?
You can actually imagine McCain. I mean, that's the thing that I kept thinking of. The last scene in the novel, which of course is Jordan waiting for the fascist troops to arrive as he single-handedly defends his friend's escape. In a lot of ways, you wonder how much of McCain's self-identification takes place there when his plane went down. I mean, the idea of waiting for the North Vietnamese, for the Viet Cong to take him prisoner. I mean, how much of that final moment in the book has a resonance? I mean, and what's interesting, too, is if you remember at the end of the novel, too, Jordan begins to realize that while the side that he's fighting for might not win right now and might not win 10 years from now, it will eventually win down the line. And you wonder if McCain, in seeing where Vietnam has come and in seeing where his own life has come, actually sees a fulfillment that Jordan doesn't, because we have to assume that the fascists were not even as merciful as the Viet Cong.
Great analysis,
Jim. So we're
going
to be looking for some clues. Maybe we should all go back and read For Whom the Bell Tolls for some clues and insight into both John McCain and Barack Obama. Jim Fitzmorris, thank you.
Thank you.
Jim Fitzmorris is a playwright, professor of theater, history, and literature at Tulane University.
It's number 12 in literature and fiction on Amazon, For Whom the Bell Tolls, and you got to figure that has something to do with it. And what Jim didn't mention is the heroes are all Republicans, Spanish Republicans, but all Republicans in For Whom the Bell Tolls. Really interesting analysis there. But we're going to shift gears one more time. Ian Johnson, are you there?
Yes, I am.
So Atlanta is so gay, right?
Apparently so, yeah.
Las Vegas, gay or not gay?
So gay.
So gay. Boston, gay?
Apparently. Massachusetts, especially this week.
And South Carolina? This is an odd one.
Well,
so
gay. No longer. Gay no longer, I think, is the advertising man's take on that.
Well, Ian, I'm speaking to you because you're founder and CEO of Out Now, who's consulted on some advertising campaigns to attract gay and lesbian tourists into places in the United States. But when you put posters saying South Carolina is so gay on places in the UK, it actually produced some irritation on the part of South Carolina officials. Can you explain?
Yes. Well, we were hired by a gay and lesbian tour company in the UK called Amro Worldwide. Out Now does this kind of work with clients, including tourism offices, national tourism offices, state tourism offices around the world, all using taxpayer funds to pay for our services. We were hired by AMRO Worldwide to put up a poster campaign in the London Underground. Our creative team came up with the idea to turn the usual insult of "that is so gay" into a positive. So if you're a gay travel company and you want to attract the attention of someone on the escalator as they go past your poster advertisement in the London Underground, the headline reading, "Las Vegas is so gay, Washington, D.C. is so gay, New Orleans is so gay, South Carolina is so gay," gets people's attention.
Yeah, you definitely got their attention. The state senator, Dwayne Davis Thomas, told a political blog that South Carolinians will be irate when they learn their hard-earned tax dollars are being spent to advertise our state as so gay. South Carolina is a wonderful, family-friendly destination, not a southern version of San Francisco. Ouch.
I think we need to make a couple of quick points. Gays and lesbians also have families. Many lesbians and gay men are already parenting, so they are also families looking for family-friendly destinations. But there's something more at work here. This is about political interference in a decision made by the South Carolina Parks, Recreation and Tourism. And there have been some mistruths I quickly want to address. The advertisements have not been pulled for South Carolina. I was in the tube station just 30 minutes ago. They are still there. A low-level employee has supposedly lost their job over this. That, I would suggest to you, is not the case. There is a higher-level management issue there. They say that they haven't paid for the campaign. That's also not true. Out Now has been paid in full.
It's unfortunate that, you know, something that is actually for the benefit of everyone in the state should motivate such hard feelings between people, don't you think?
I think it's a shame. It really shocked me that the politicians in South Carolina would do this. I think the people that we need to think of most in all of this are the tourism industry players in South Carolina who Out Now was trying to help by increasing gay travel business, as we have for many other destinations around the world. Those people will lose millions of dollars because of the decisions of their politicians.
Quick question. Arkansas, so gay or not?
I'm not commenting because
not
they're
really.
Not part of our campaign.
Right.
We have six destinations, and for those purposes, those ones are so gay, with the exception now of South Carolina.
Aleutian Islands, Alaska, so gay?
Well, the honest answer is you'll find gay communities in most areas of the world. South Carolina chased AMRO Worldwide, the tour company that we work for, to be included. We didn't chase South Carolina.
That's a great point. Ian Johnson, founder and CEO of Out Now, thanks so much for joining us from London.
You're very welcome.
All right.
You know what, John? We're going to look forward to tomorrow, and that is Nelson Mandela turns 90, and we're going to have
Incredible.
A special celebration for him.
It is an idea for which I hope to live for and to see realized. But my Lord, if it needs be, it is an idea for which I am prepared to die.
That's Mandela's voice speaking there in 1964.
Defending himself.
Incredible. Here's the takeaway for this hour.
I think chefs aren't aware of fast food.
It's Camille Bissara sorting high calories from low. You can play our calorie game on our website and see video of confused consumers counting calories.
And if you missed anything on the show, you can check us out on iTunes and Friend Feed. I'm Adora Udoji.
I'm John Huckenberry.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.